These aren't easy times, as we all in our own ways are buffeted by the challenging conditions for many beings on this planet. Illness, aging, finding enough resources, those being oppressed and feeling under threat, those in pain, those being attacked. Just negotiating this life is not easy. The Buddha called his land, this world, the Saha world, which means to be endured, or that which is difficult to endure. It's difficult to endure, but there's also an incredible opportunity to take these conditions and illuminate them, to reveal the path home. So in the midst of this turbulence, we can ask the question, what is trustworthy? And I feel such gratitude that for 50 years I've recognized the incredible trustworthy triple jewel, the Buddha, the Dharma, the Sangha. So I want to begin just with a short recitation honoring the Buddha and the qualities of the triple jewel that are the foundation of the path of awakening that Buddha opened up, and that become vehicles, they're frameworks that we ride, that carry us home to our true nature.
Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Homage to the blessed, noble, and perfectly enlightened one. Homage to the blessed, noble, and perfectly enlightened one. Homage to the blessed, noble, and perfectly enlightened one. Itipiso ambakawa alahang sama samputa vija chalana sam noa sukata loka vidu anuttaro apulisata masalati satta deva manusanang putto bakawa tisava kato bhagavata tam santitiko akaliko ehipa sikoho panayiko pajatam vetitambo in yuhi tisupati pano bhagavato savaka sangho ujupati pano bhagavato savaka sangho yaya pati pano bhagavato savaka sangho samichi pati pano savaka sangho yatitang chat Tari purisa yugania ta purisa pukala esa pakavato savaka sanko a unayo pa unayo dakinayo anchali kalaniyo anu tarang punya ketang lo kasati.
sounding, the qualities of the Triple Jewel, the sources of inspiration that right from the early days of the Buddha's awakening, he offered as trustworthy grounds for support, for guidance, carried on the breath, bringing together body, speech, and mind. When one makes a sound, carried on breath, that's body guided by the mind, speech, thinking mind, held in awareness that's listening, patient. The Buddha taught this technology that when we honor what is worthy of honor, we partake of that blessing. It's like plugging in. Recitation is important. Technology, skillful means that the Buddha taught for purifying, cleansing, realigning. Our body, mind, with true principle. Taking this opportunity to welcome our body, mind, this community. We're all across the globe, but we're pulled to the center by one Pachamama, one earth. And we welcome into this moment the experience of our body, whatever posture we're in, being pulled to ground, allowing that sensation of touching ground, the weight of this earth body touching ground, to be received. And this body, though it sounds separate, is a noun. It's actually being continually blessed by the gift from the trees, giving ourselves permission to, in our own time, take a few appreciative, long, slow in-breaths and out-breaths as we receive the life-sustaining. Gift from Mother Nature. That in-breath brightens, it brings that prana, that vitalizing principle into every cell in the body. That long, slow out-breath as we relax, softening the face, jaws, neck, shoulder, down from the crowns of the body. Breathing in long, breathing out long, with that relaxation allows that blessing to be shared with every cell in the body. As we relax, we also sense the body's alignment with ground. If we're sitting, we might lean one direction, the other direction, and find that centrality, not forward, not back. When we consciously align this little earth body with the deep, immeasurable ground of Mother Earth, and this body is aligned, we partake of Mother Earth's power, stabilizing, vibrant, stabilizing steadiness. Giving ourselves permission to receive this body mind, listening, breathing. All this activity happening within the refuge of Buddha, awareness, that which knows the sound of my voice, appearing and dissolving, knows, recognizes immediately, intuitively, when there's a swelling of the in-breath, subsiding of the out-breath. For this time of pause, of checking into how it is, on that long out-breath, we can allow it to become more natural, but we can inwardly whisper, just let go. Not a forceful getting rid of anything, but allowing things to come and go. With each out-breath of letting be or letting go, we're allowing the sensations of the body, the swelling, the subsiding, the various feeling tones to vibrate, to be as they are, allowing the sounds to appear and dissolve. Also our moods, our feeling tones of ease or distress, worry or anticipation, agitation or serenity, whatever. The mood as we let be, let go, we're allowing things to shift. So it's a paradox. We're steadying on the stabilizing sensation of just whatever our posture is, sitting or standing or walking or lying down. And yet within that foundation of just being with the body as it is, breathing in and out, there's a recognition, a patient allowing of the change, sounds. Feeling tone. Thoughts coming and going. Everything arises and ceases, always returning to this ground of the Buddha, what's called the essential nature, the true nature. We might notice that our mind has wandered. That's what the mind does. That's why there's practice. That recognition that we've wandered is already the beginning of the return, the awakening. This timeless knowing nature is always here and now, said the Buddha. It's one of the qualities I recited of the Dharma, that this luminous shining nature is always here now. We forget, get entangled in some story. That's okay, patiently. Beginning again, a sacred word or phrase, quietly, just like let go, or the one we were taught in my early monastic life was Buddho, Buddho. It's the name of the Buddha, it just means the awakened one, the knowing one, Buddho. A little bubble of a sound appears and dissolves, and as it dissolves, it reminds the heart to rest in that ever-present dimension of being. Let go works the same way. These short phrases could be called sacred phrases. Encourage, remind the heart to remember its foundation. It's home ground. take this opportunity to reflect on the Dharma, the teachings of the Buddha. In the qualities that are recited, the first quality of the Dharma is referring to this exoteric, the texts, the words that the Buddha taught. I chanted Savakato Bhagavata Dhammo. It's this external dimension of the Dharma is well expressed. But when we hear and contemplate these sounds, these ideas, these dimensions, the whole purpose of the Dharma is to guide one back to the timeless Dharma. Yes, the Dharma texts, the Four Noble Truths, the teachings on kindness, compassion, joy, equanimity, suffering and the ending of suffering, these are valuable, but they're guidelines, they're maps, that's what's well expressed, but the timeless Dhamma, the Buddha said, is sandittiko, akaliko, ehipasiko. It's sandittiko, here and now, it's right here. Timeless, akaliko. Ehipasiko, it's inviting us. Ehi means open, armed, it means come. Pasiko means come see. The Dharma, this true nature, is like inviting us, pulling us. Because that's our nature. I began by talking about the experience in the world. There's a lot of being shook up. At least I get shook up. Here in America is very stressful with all the instability and the lawlessness and the powers that be and the regime, masked people, pulling people off streets, even citizens being killed. That's just one little pocket, but then there's so much suffering around the world. Shaken. I want to talk about a Dharma teaching the Buddha gave called the Sharangama Sutra. That means unshakable. So being shaken, turned, disturbed, distressed, anxious, buffeted. And then there's this word Sharangama, the Sharangama Sutra. The Sharangama as the word means ultimately durable. It means indestructible, means unshakable. And so I want to read you a short passage from the Sharangama Sutra about the two fundamental roots. It's one I recite very frequently, almost every day, not every day. But I contemplate it regularly. Well, I just recited, I can't see very well. The reason those who cultivate cannot accomplish unsurpassed bodhi, but instead reach the level of a sound hearer, or one enlightened conditions, or become accomplished in outside ways as heaven dwellers or as demon kings, is that they do not know the two fundamental roots and are mistaken and confused in their cultivation. They're like one who cooks sand in the hope of creating savory delicacies. They may pass through as many eons as there are motes of dust, but in the end, they will not obtain what they want. What are the two? Ananda, the first is the root of beginningless birth and death. which is the mind that seizes upon conditions, and that you and all living beings now make use of, taking it to be the self nature. The second is the primal pure substance of the beginningless Bodhi Nirvana. It is the primal bright essence of consciousness that can bring forth all conditions. Because of conditions, you consider it to be lost. Living beings lose sight of the original brightness. Therefore, though they use it to the end of their days, they are unaware of it and without intending to enter the various destinies. So that first part, the reason those who cultivate cannot accomplish the unsurpassed Bodhi. Those who cultivate, I think everyone is here. No one would be here if they didn't have some sense of, if we all didn't have faith, some trust that there was a possibility of growing beyond our worry, our doubt, our fear, our suffering, I don't think we'd come to Sangha life. So we all have some trust that there is a possibility of freeing, that activity of cultivating that. That's what's called cultivation. The reason those who cultivate cannot accomplish unsurpassed Bodhi, that means, why aren't we Buddhas? The Buddha is just the ordinary human being who was awakened. We all have the Buddha nature, but we're still confused. But all the treasures of awakening are right here and now. So the reason that those who cultivate don't recognize this wonderful nature of a Buddha, but instead, and then it's talking about all the different ways in which we can find ourselves in hellish states, we can find ourselves in hungry ghost states, nothing's ever enough. We can find ourselves in heavenly, lulled in the harmony of the heavenly state, which is still impermanent. The mixture, the asuric state, the titans, the competitive, battling, dominant, hateful states. Those that are caught up in those, that's what's called demon. They're energies, but when we're just caught up in these energies of greed, selfish greed, the energy of hatefulness is just delights in destroying, harming. It's a part of nature. But the Buddha says, why we aren't a Buddha is that we do not know the two fundamental roots and are mistaken and are confused in our cultivation. And this is this simile, powerful simile. They're like one who cooks sand in the hope of creating savory delicacies. Imagine that. Someone in hungry, needing nourishment, cooking sand. There's a lot of effort there. Maybe a lot of heat. Perhaps 10 out of 10 for dedication, but in this image, one will just reap weariness and disappointment, because when you cook sand, it becomes hot sand, or maybe melts. There's this image, they may pass through as many eons. An eon is a kalpa, an incredibly long period of time. They may pass through as many eons as there are motes of dust, but in the end they will not obtain what they want. So this is where it's cultivation. Yes, it's good to be dedicated and have energy, but this is talking about our practice needs to be guided by some understanding. Otherwise, our energy might, even though it's still honorable in a sense, well-intentioned, but that cooking sand is a kind of image of samsara, perpetual disappointment. Or in Zen, they have this saying, it's like polishing a brick, hoping to get a mirror. One could just be, don't bother, excuse me, I'm busy. It's going to be an incredible mirror. It's going to be amazing. You polish a brick, you don't get a mirror. So what is that first root? Ananda, his beloved attendant, who had an incredible memory and memorize the teachings. That's one of the reasons why we have access. The root of beginningless birth and death. Birth and death means that's feeling like we've arrived and then disappointed. We're happy and then we're unhappy. We're successful and then it eludes us. We understand and then we can't remember. We find ourselves totally bombarded with remorse and resentment. That's birth and death, as well as getting old and sick and dying. And then, according to the Buddhist understanding, the citta reestablishes itself and is born somewhere else. But we do that all the time in our daily life. The root of beginningless birth and death, which is the mind that seizes upon conditions and that you and all living beings now make use of, taking it to be the self nature. This grasping it, like the in-breath. Oh, I like the in-breath. It's refreshing. Oh, the out-breath's a bit stale. Ah, but the in-breath, that's where you get the energy. Okay, if we take what I like, the in-breath, and I know this is a silly example, but we like the inspiration, but then we're always going to be bumpy, getting it, losing it, getting it, losing it. Attaching to pleasant feeling, or praise, or things in harmony. The mind that seizes upon it means that it holds on to, identifies with, taking it to be the self nature. It seems to be me. We get acknowledged and praised by someone, and it feels good. Oh, they noticed. I'm not such a bad person, am I? Oh. And then the next person just ignores us. Then we start, and even raises their eyebrow. Then we hear them talking to someone else, criticizing us. The extent to which we've attached to the praise, we get shaken by blame, by criticism. These are called the worldly winds. It's this mind. That seizes upon conditions, taking it to be me. And what is the second, the primal pure substance of the beginningless Bodhi Nirvana? Bodhi means awakening. The pure, there's a pure substance of the beginningless. It's not bound in time. Time is just like this sound. The word time appears and this world dissolves. Time happens within the sense of an in-breath and out-breath appears within this Bodhi, this awakened, this listening, this aware. Nibbana. Nibbana means cool, unflustered. The second root is the primal pure substance, the beginningless Bodhi Nirvana. It's the primal bright essence of consciousness that can bring forth all conditions. That's an interesting thought. This root of the Bodhi, of awakening, of awareness, all conditions come, are brought forth out of that. Every sound, every sight, every mood, every experience appears and returns all within this one mind. But because of conditions, you consider it to be lost. Well, when we're in pain or when we're confused, oh, I've lost my nature, I've lost my true nature. So then we think, oh, it's over there. And that, oh, it's over there, we grasp at another condition, at another pleasant condition, or an inspiring condition, or a safe condition. But that's the like cooking sand. Ajahn Chah put it like this: when we look for certainty in that which is uncertain, we're bound to suffer. Looking for certainty in that which is uncertain, like the body, oh, when it feels good, ah, oh, finally cracked that sore back thing. Then if we lean on that, but actually, even when the back feels good, it's vibrating. It's not certain. Every sight, every sound, every sensation, every feeling tone, every moment, even the word, is by nature, conditionality is ephemeral. It's uncertain. Yet, we look for certainty in that which is uncertain. The Buddha, Ajahn Chah, my Thai master, said, well, you're bound to suffer. We're asking conditions what they can't give us. He was very earthy. He learned in the forest. He said, that's like going up to a duck and saying, why are you a chicken? I know you quack, quack. That's all right, but you could cuckoo doodle doo. You could wake up. You could be useful, not just quack, quack, quack. A duck's a duck. A chicken's a chicken. He said it's like standing by a river and shouting at it. You're flowing the wrong way. You should go the other way. Or he said it's like boxing a tree. If you box a tree, Ajahn Chah said, you're going to get hurt. Conditions are conditions. There's nothing wrong with them. If we honor the nature of what comes and goes, that's why the reflection on impermanence is so powerful. Because noticing a condition shift and change, that's already the beginning of the great return to start to open up the second root. To reveal that heart of awareness. The Buddha with that second root, he said, living beings lose sight of the original brightness, therefore they use it. Therefore, though they use it to the end of their days, they are unaware of it, and without intending to, they enter the various destinies. The original brightness is always here and now. Every moment we're using it. But when we're mesmerized by objects, holding to the pleasure, holding to the success, holding to the praise, holding to the control, this, another way of talking about cultivation, reflecting on the first root and then beginning to open to the second root, this timeless Buddha nature. It can be called radical reflection. Radical means connected to root, the return to the root. So we're not declaring war against objects, but we're just honoring those apparent objects that sound like things. Our thoughts make praise sound like a thing. The in-breath is a thing. You can hold on to it. Success is a thing. But when we start to touch in-breath with listening, we see it vibrating. Same with pleasure, success. And we start to see all these apparent objects. They're concretized because of our wrong understanding of thinking. But we see these apparent objects are ephemeral and empty, revealing this ever-present, shining heart. The Buddha said this process in the Lotus Sutra, this process of not understanding the first root, the simile he gave was, it's like a yak enamored with its tail. The wonderful creatures that helped us when we circumambulated the holy mountain in Tibet, Mount Kailash. Tanisra, my beloved wife, got altitude situation and she just said, "Kitty, sorry, I can't go on, leave me." I said, "Tanisra, not leave you." She was quite peaceful just to die there. But this, miraculously, this monk who had met Tanisra on the north face the night before sent a yak. He must have foreseen that she was going to go through this. And the little female yak took Tanisra up to the top. And then every step down, she felt better and better and better. But evidently, yak can get enamored with its tail. Imagine a yak trying to. We never get there. That's another image for samsara. That's what happens when our thoughts, seeming success is right around the corner. If I just hold. For me in meditation, these refined states that I so loved getting peaceful. Then I wanted to get more peaceful and more peaceful. Thinking. That's a thing, not realizing that more peaceful, less peaceful. It's like the in and the out breath. That's all appearing and dissolving within the unshakable, the sharangama, the ever-present. Return to the root. A wonderful reminder and helping us get objects into perspective is this saying that we practiced a lot within the monastery. As space is to form, so there's you, me, the computers, but all this, my body sitting here, is in infinite space. Without space, there is no form. You couldn't talk about a form. You, me, here, there, as space is to form. There is no form without infinite surrounding space. As space is to form and silence is to sound, so is awareness to all experience, to all phenomena. We get so enamored with the sounds. Oh, they like me, they don't like me. I can't believe they're doing that outrageous. I mean, they're just killing people. They're doing this. And these are. And yet that experience is also happening within a deep, unshakable ground, sacred ground. As space is the form and silence is the sound, so is awareness. To all experience, all phenomenon. Knowing this deep, peaceful ground is not to say that there's never anything we need to attend to. There's a lot to meet, and we're all trying to do our best to alleviate suffering within and in our community and in our country and world. But if we're always on the front line getting exhausted every moment, we just get shredded. Very important to know that even in the midst of a storm, that storm is swirling within this deep space, this space-like awareness that's unmoving, unshakable, luminous, what the Buddha called the original brightness. So occasionally, that's where the sacred words are so useful. The name of Kuan Yin, or the name of the Buddha, or even the word let go, or even the word here and now, these are part of the conditionality that's ever changing. Like Buddho, that word appears and dissolves, but that word reminds us for a moment that there's this deep root, this ground that's always here inviting us. So we let that sacred word of Kuan Yin or Buddha just sound, mixed with all the swirls of our emotions and of the conditions of life. But it allows us to rest for a moment in the silent listening. These two fundamental roots were also in a wonderful, succinct Pali Sutta called the Mula Sutta, the Root Sutra. What brings, rooted in desire, are all things. So it's desire that manifests all the particularities of the cosmos. Born of attention are all things. Arising on contact are all things. Converging on feeling are all things. This is when we're really hemmed in by it. We get so excited about pleasure sometimes and so overwhelmed by pain. Headed by concentration are all things. This is when we get fixated. That's not the concentration that necessarily liberates. We get fixated. This is terrible. We get overwhelmed. But there's just 10 lines. But the next line is the beginning of the return. Ruled by mindfulness are all things. When we just pause, whatever's happening, hey, can we just notice it? What is actually happening here? And then the next line is surmounted by wisdom. Panyuttarasa betama is the Pali. That wisdom then will see, oh, even this circumstance is actually changing. Whatever it is, whether it's sickness, criticism, harm. Vimuttisarasa betama, the next line is one of my favorites. Vimutti means freedom. Sara is the heartwood, the essence, sabedama of all things. Every circumstance has as its essence freedom. Like right now, however we are, is happening within this liberated heart that's not somewhere else. The next line is Amato Gadasa Bedama, merging in the deathless are all things. All this different, seemingly separative world all comes together, is not split, is unified in that which is the amata. Amato, ama means amato, gada sabedama, merging in the deathless are all things. Nibbana pariyosana sabedama, culminating in Nibbana are all things. Those are the two roots, how desire that attaches. But then as we start to apply mindfulness, the mindfulness goes one direction. It takes us back home to this ever-present heart. Once Ajahn Chah was on alms round with some monks. I wasn't there on that occasion, but I got told. And he pointed to some big boulders in the rice fields. And he said to them, "Are those heavy? Are those boulders heavy?" And the disciples thought, "Well, that's an easy one." "Yes, Lumpa." Lumpa means, it's an affectionate, reverential term. It means venerable father. One felt so safe around Ajahn Chah. I love that phrase, Lumpa. The monk said, "Yes, Lumpa, they're very heavy." And Lumpa, with his ubiquitous, with his kind of grunt, he said, "They're not heavy unless you lift them. They're not heavy unless you try to lift them." How many are we wrestling with boulders? And in a moment, just to be able to, and that's why these periods of meditation is we learn how to just let things be. We think, oh, if I let go, we imagine, oh, I've abdicated. No. In letting things be, we touch again this ever-free healing, all-enveloping heart that sees things as they are, and then with that ground, from that trustworthy ground, we then can meet the problem with this having to do it all the time and holding all these boulders. We get exhausted, we get frustrated, and then it's like the cooking sand. It's the yak chasing its tail. So I reflect on these two fundamental roots a lot, from the Mula Sutta to the Sharangama Sutta. There is this Shalangama, unshakable ground that the Buddha taught is always here and now. It's always inviting us. It's magnetic, because as we relax, because it's our true nature, it's pulling us. When the sixth Zen patriarch was enlightened, his first words were, "How unexpected! How unexpected!" Unexpected because it wasn't something he got. It was a profound surrender and waking up to what's always already been here. Yes, conditions. All conditions are right here. Dhamma is so wonderful, I could talk forever. And that could be a problem. Caroline would have to kind of pry me off. Okay, so I shall leave it there. Made some Dhamma reflections. Please forgive me for anything that has been hurtful or not landed right. You can just let that go. But it is an honor and a real blessing to practice together. And I want to thank Sangha Lai for being this wonderful platform that allows me the chance to be with you, to meet you. And as Caroline said, it's supported by the foundational virtue, generosity, that our time here is already a gift, but also if you can make a gesture to Sangha Life so that this opportunity can continue for others, that would be wonderful. And now we also have some time in case there is anyone who has any comments or reflections. You can raise your hand, or also, I'm not so good at, but I might be able to see it. Oh, it says Carol Jewel just told this same story. I don't know which story that was, but anyway, I'm glad it's echoing. But anyway, if there is anything anyone would like to reflect on or ask about or comment on with this reflection on the two roots, you're very welcome. Oh, the boulder, Ajahn Chah boulder story. Yes, thank you for all the appreciation, everyone. Bertie, how do I pronounce your name? You're so welcome to talk. I'd love to hear you say your name.
Hi, Kirisaro. It's Bartek. It's fine. Yeah, it's good.
Oh, beautiful. Bartek, welcome.
Hi, Kirisaro. It's so nice to be here and also having you here. Kirisaro. I like the intro. With the chanting, it was inspiring and also showing some dedication and devotion to the practice. And that's already something we can learn from, you know, from you by doing that. So sometimes can be skipped, like we trying to jump into something, you know, that we like. But this is exactly what we need, you know, the preparation for what needs to be nourished first, and then we can plant, you know, those seeds. Yeah, I like those chantings. They're very. And Kirisara, you said Nibbana, you know, the word, and I was hooked in already, you know, like, okay, Nibbana, you know, that sounds really tempting, and that's what we're experiencing is every day, you know, is that letting go the quality that we have in the mind, that we can let go of what we're dragging, you know, it's like the boulders, you know, the heavy stuff, you know, that we're carrying around, you know, it's not heavy at all. So can we experience this profound Nibbana in everyday you know, daily routine, like what we do also? Is that what we looking for, you know, in this Nibbana, what you're talking? Or is it profound Nibbana that we can experience only on a retreat, and then we can experience those deeper mind states where there's just peace and stillness? Or how can you
Thank you. No, that's a very good
explain
question.
That?
Yeah,
Oh, thank you.
For many of us, our first glimpses can happen on retreat, but it's very much when the Buddha, those aren't just empty words, that this quality, dimension of peace, serenity, the original brightness is always here and now and in a moment where everyone is. Of seeing things as they are, really acknowledging the ephemeral nature of things. Because when we see, if you're standing in front of a waterfall, you might be telling people, I got a waterfall on my land. It's incredible. You should see the rainbows on there. It's on my land. It's on my land. I know, I let people come have a look. But it's incredible. It's on my land, mind you. But if you get right close to a waterfall and see it swirling in the mist in those moments of awe, those can happen anytime. And so that's why the practice is just so important. We shouldn't limit ourselves to think, oh God, it might not even try. I might have to do a whole month retreat to get anywhere. That's why the chanting is so important. It is a technology, particularly for lay life. In monastic life, you have so much other things supporting the cultivation of calm and steadiness and dedication. But chanting is very much a bridge. So if you recite something, and as reciting, like when I was reciting those qualities of the Triple Jewel, Itipiso, Bhagava, Arahang, Sam, as I recite, I'm letting the ephemeral sounds be touched with presence. I know they're ungraspable. So as I'm reciting, I'm touching, like right now I'm talking, but as I'm talking, I'm aware of that deep silence within the talking. There's that which never moves right in the midst of talking. So in the daily life, you can pause in any moment and just say, what's not moving? Well, the sounds are moving. I can hear the air conditioner in the background vibrating and moving. But what's not moving? And then you let that question, what's not moving? That question ends, and for a moment there's a space. What's not moving? Well, just listen. That there's a whole teaching around this, but the problem, what leads us to continually not experience nibbana, is that we're thinking so much. And imagining that all these external objects, the great architect of substantiality, is thinking. But if we have a short thought that reveals its ephemeral nature, like what's here? That's a short thought. What's here? But it leaves a space and just an open mind that's inquiring. Then the boundaries for that moment aren't there. There's just the quiet consideration. So, as you practice this, one can then have little mini nibbanas in one's daily life. And it's still bumpy, but in cultivation, we're little by little, just in a moment of seeing that sounds change, just even that.
Yeah.
Sounds change. We're that's part of what's called the great return. That's this allowing the heart to begin to rest in its own suchness. So thank you for that.
Thank you, Kitisaro. That's a great explanation. I will definitely remember that question, that was
Very good.
here. Thank you very much, Kitisaro. That will
Thank
be
you.
a great reminder. Thank you. Nice talking to you.
Hello, Owen. Welcome. I can't hear you yet.
Is are you, can you hear this? Yep. Well, I arrived here kind of later than expected because I usually arrive on time, but I wasn't really paying you much attention, I guess. I was busy with other things. But when I did arrive, I was in the middle of the meditation. And I don't really practice with the breath, but I do practice with my heart, my feelings right down in here because I have a lot of anxiety, have panic. I even have panic occasionally, usually triggered by something, by an anticipation of something really horrible happening. Because I also catastrophize too. And that was like very, very, like when I started into the meditation, it was really difficult. It was like for me, it was very like unsettling. It felt like really turbulent internally. I was just having racing like kind of thoughts. I was like focusing in like and then like here. And like it did like last for a couple minutes, but eventually I did settle into what I turn what can be called a kind of like the nature, the nature of like the your being of the being. Like a Buddha nature of sorts. but it's like awareness. So I settled into that eventually, but it was a turbulent kind of settle beforehand. It was a turbulent kind of settling. So I settled into like a state of being that was like where I am right now. Like I'm kind of still have that feeling, but I'm aware of that feeling. But I'm like a calm kind of like a basic okayness with it. Let's say right now. And like with the settled like idea of it, like the anxiety eventually formed an image. Like the image that was forming of that feeling in my body was like kind of like a rat. That part, I call it a part. Like it kind of saw, I kind of had like a rat. It was like a leg like a rat. It had a rat imagery. And it was like a scared rat or anxious rat. It was that was circling. And that also really calmed me down because I could tend to it, like could be tender to it with my attention. And I've done this sort of thing before. I do a little bit of IFS here and there. That's a therapy framework. I'm big into that kind of framework where it is like there is a state called the self that is very, very similar to the Buddha nature, but it's more, it's less explicitly referencing the Buddha nature, but it is very based in it. And I've had that several times where I went inside and have that tenderness towards that. But this imagery of like an animal is very new to me, because I used to think that was a person, like a little baby, like a human baby. But no, apparently it's like a rat, or like the other part, another part of it is like this imagery of a bear elephant. And it's like this rage part that I've also had like a kind of tenderness towards.
Yes, well, gosh, Owen, that's practice. You're practicing, and that's that is, you know, and that these orphans of consciousness, that's what our teacher called them. These dimensions, when we don't contemplate them, then they just become like you could have just said when that first agitation came. You just said, "Well, can't meditate. This is no good." By you summoning you that deep cultivation of patience and that deeper faith, you have a deeper trust that no, there's something worth doing here. Let's stay with this. You then were able to become more dispassionate, so to speak, more able to see that this is just a part of nature. And then you got the nimitta, the image, of the rat. It's an incredible image of samsara too, and that way these what has been not investigated, locked into the dungeons, just reacted to, then I think you use the word you can care for it, you can be tender and sensitive. That's how the natural healing happens. Now as this process deepens little by little, these the Buddha called them sankharas. These conditioned tendencies get purified. And what is a mind that is quite bumpy and reactive, it becomes, there's a beautiful image the Buddha says, this citta, this heart, little by little becomes a wonderful luminous mirror. It's able to perfectly respond and, you know, it's a work in progress, but it's able then to spontaneously reflect and the actual nature of things and respond. So anyway, thank you for joining, and it's lovely to hear you again. I heard you last week when my wife was there, so thank you for speaking up, Owen.
Yep, you too.
Charles, welcome.
Yeah, thank you. I'm sorry, I came a little late, but I'm just hearing your. It sounds like basically you're talking about roots. Root of, and so I just was wondering, I've been thinking a lot about awareness and presence and consciousness and how they relate to each other. And somehow it seems to me that that's what we're talking, that what we're talking about, roots.
Absolutely. Well, that's the root of, remember, there's two roots here the Buddha's talking about that are ultimately all part of one suchness. But then we're going to use words to isolate two originating principles. One principle, foundational principle, what's called the root of beginningless birth and death, is the mind that identifies with, that holds on to, that, like, for example, when Owen was talking about the agitated state, when if one just attaches to that, then you can just think, I'm an agitated person. That's true, but it's also not true. By being patient, then seeing that state's actually not just me, it's something that is a changing condition, one then starts to open up to a deeper dimension of the heart, which is not agitated, which is calm. Now, there are subtle layers of consciousness that are also changing. That's why one can get very attached to refined states. I used to love getting peaceful, and then I would, like a snapping turtle, want to hold on to that thing. And it's skillful to get peaceful, but that's also something that one can grasp at. But as long as there's this identifying with and taking something to be me and mine, that leads to this experience called suffering or birth and death. When there is the letting go of that, there's the recognition that all of these different subtle states and forms and circumstances are all happening in what's called that second root, which is the true nature, which is always here now. It's not coming and going. It just is. But
is that the suchness you're talking about?
That's suchness. The Buddha called it also, he gave different words, Nibbana, but he had different words. But as they say in the Tao, the name that can be named is not the eternal name. So you can call it, I don't mind if you call it God, you can call it whatever you want it, but it's the Buddha also, another word he used is Tathagata Garbha. Tathagata means such, the one who's such. Garbha means womb. So that means
that
a primordial
means what?
Womb, W-O-M-B, womb.
Oh, right, okay, yeah.
So the primordial matrix, so it's like awareness. There's a primordial matrix within which all manifestation happens. And so this first root is this true nature, which is always here and now, but then we overlook it when we're busy focused on objects that we then take to be me and mine. The path of cultivation, as we start to see all these things shift and change, that's why it's called the Great Return. We start more and more to realize, wow, this is all happening here, and this here is not coming and going. So another phrase the Buddha used for that is called deathless. There's a dimension of our experience that's not coming and going, that doesn't die. Words die. It's called timeless because time happens within forms, within thoughts, but that which registers time. So there's this beautiful paradox. The more one honors ephemerality, the more one allows things to change. How ironic, the more one honors that, we find ourselves abiding with the timeless.
Abiding. So,
yeah.
I just want to, can I interrupt you? I'm sorry.
Yeah.
But that's Well, I have this little list here. I got consciousness, presence, awareness, suchness, and now you're adding abidance.
Yeah, so consciousness
So
is
are they
comfortable.
all the same?
No, well, it depends on how you use words. Like, for example, notice in my quote, I don't know if you were here for that, but in the quote, the Buddha called the second root, the, where did I put the, he called the second root, the primal bright essence of consciousness. Now,
What the
some
essence
Buddha,
of
you see, the word, let me finish this, Charles.
Okay.
The consciousness in the language the Buddha spoke, vijnana, jnana means no, vijnana means, it can be translated as separative knowing, like I consciousness is you're registering the sign, and there's a sense of subject object, I consciousness, ear consciousness, so that's called Chaku vijnana is eye consciousness, sota vijnana is ear con. That's a sep. That kind of consciousness is not impermanent. I mean, it's not deathless. Sights and sounds and sensations come and go. That's a kind of consciousness. But the Buddha is saying the essence of consciousness. You notice sights and sounds come and go, and that's where I like to use the word awareness, but it just depends on how people use the word. Awareness has more of that timeless. So one has to be careful, because some people hear me read that quote and think, oh, Kitty Sorrells, he's saying heresy. The Buddha said that consciousness is part of the khandhas and they dissolve. And now he's talking about the essence of consciousness. It depends on how you use the word. Use words. There is that dimension of experience that's why the Buddha often used the negative, that doesn't die. You know, so oftentimes he referred to these to this principle by saying it's a negative. It's not coming and going. It's not suffering. It's not self. But on the other hand,
it's changeless. Is it changeless?
Changeless. But then if people misinterpret that, they think that this is an annihilation. That's why sometimes the Buddha uses these positive words just to encourage the heart to trust that when you let go, you're not just going into oblivion. When one lets go, one is allowing the heart to be restored to its inherent timeless luminosity, what the Buddha called the original brightness.
Well, that's enough for me. Thank you so much.
Thank you for the question, Charles. Thank you for your comments. Oh, is there another? Let me read your name. Is that another Charles?
Yes. Yes.
Oh, please. Welcome.
I hope my question will fit into the remaining time, but it's sort of a big question, and that is my understanding. I'm fairly recent to this. Buddha, their life involves suffering, and everything is impermanent. It's the everything is impermanent that causes me a little difficulty. Number one is, and this is me talking, I believe it's human nature to seek solid ground as we proceed through the river of life. You step on one stone, you don't get off that one until your foot's on the next stone. Those are all solid, hopefully permanent foundations as the river of life flows and you traverse it. But my question is, you said there are two routes, and I'll try to get it on video, didn't hear the beginning of the talk today, but you said there are two routes, one of which is vast and natural and sort of stable and always there, i.e. permanent, and the other is not, and we tend to cling to the permanent. Well, when does stepping on stones so you can maneuver through life become clinging? And if what are you clinging to if everything is impermanent?
Right, no, it's very good question. Thank you. All the Buddha's words are just skillful means to encourage us. Like the Buddha would encourage when we're a child, sometimes we hold on to our mother's hand. That's a, you don't scold the child too early, oh, don't cling. You know, we need so the Buddha did give, like having a good friend and being honest and being generous, these are, and trying to be truthful. These are things that, you know, at first we start out clinging to them, but there's, it's a skillful clinging. It's called holding on to that which is wholesome, holding on to that which is trustworthy. And so that is really good. But as we sometimes we start to enter the path when we start to encounter suffering, and then we think, well, what, why am I distressed now? And that's when the Buddha starts to give this reflective teaching, that these things that we identify with, we start to just be honest and notice that praise, for example, and even even when we're stepping on the stones in the river, is and there's a steadiness that's skillful, but we notice that that moment ends, and then there's another step, and occasionally we slip and fall. When we start to add into our life the dimension of reflectiveness, then we start to see that every single sound, like right now as I'm talking, the sounds are appearing and dissolving. And in between words, we don't keel over dead. In between words are vibrating, and then in between, there's still presence, there's still something that is actually, in English, we used to know this dimension of mind. When you say mind your step, that doesn't mean think something. Mind your step is a thought that encourages one to just to ponder, to be in contact with the terrain or where one is. It's not a thought. It's an awareness. And so as one starts to see things changing, then already we're starting to get in touch with a deeper dimension of awareness. Usually when someone doesn't reflect, when there's a condition, when they're happy, they're just happy. When they're unhappy, they're just unhappy. They react. When we start to notice moods and thoughts and feeling tones, then we're starting to enter this terrain. It's beginning of the return to notice this root of the heart, this root of awareness. As one more deeply enters that, one touches into what words can't capture, but which is a reality. It's just what's not coming and not going. So yes, there is, we do, and your question, how do we know when we're clinging? We practice with it. You know, if one holds to the thought, I shouldn't cling to anything, therefore I shouldn't meditate, I don't want to cling to meditation, then we're just on automatic. So it is useful to skillfully, the Buddha encouraged the conscious. He didn't use clinging, but getting close to, holding on to good friends, elements of the path, practice. But then as it gets more subtle, we start then to notice in moments, what does it mean just to let things be? And so, but you know, that's a very profound question. It's a good question, but that's something that you find that balance just by doing just what you're doing now, asking yourself, hey, is this skillful or unskillful? And when something is clinging, it's leading to an unnecessary suffering. like, for example, when my back's hurting and I'm just, oh God, there it is again. And but then in a moment when I say, what is this? And let it, it's pain, but what is pain? It just is what it is. And in a moment of not carrying it or fighting it, it's still painful, but how interesting, we add more pain to things by the attachment, by the thinking it should be different. And in those moments, then when I really touch a circumstance with presence, then there's the peace of just, ah, that's a moment of returning to the original brightness. So thank you for that question, and thank you everyone for your time. I'd like to just pause for a moment and wish that may the goodness of our efforts, our reflections, our making space and time for something important, this reflection on the nature of reality, this meeting with kindred spirits, may these blessings, with the ease of just relaxing, like a pebble dropping into a pool, naturally sends ripples, ever-expanding ripples in all directions. So too may the goodness of our time together in our practice, with the ease of each out-breath, be shared with all beings above, below, and all around. May all beings be touched by our work. May all beings be freed from suffering. May all beings realize the peace.